thousand who have died, believing that we all were on their side. Well, there's things that never will be right, I know, and things need changing everywhere you go. But till we start to make a move to make a few things right, you'll never see me wear a suit of white. Oh, I'd love to wear a rainbow every day and tell the world that everything's okay. But I'll try to carry off a little darkness on my back till things are brighter. I'm the man in black.
I'm Phil Drew, administrator. I'm joined on the phone by Alan Bach. He is the senior columnist for the Orange County Register. He's a regular contributor to antiwar.com. He is the author of Ambush at Ruby Ridge, How Government Agents Set Randy Weaver Up and Took His Family Down, which is an excellent book I read a few years ago. Used to write for WorldNet Daily. I guess you don't write for WorldNet Daily anymore, correct?
No, I'm not sure what they decided.
Okay. And also the author of a book, Waiting to Inhale, The Politics of Medical Marijuana. And I found one more thing when searching your name on the internet, sir. I found a book called The Ecology Action Guide, and I didn't know if that was one of yours or somebody else with the same name.
I wrote that. Gosh, must be 25 years ago now.
Oh, interesting. Very good. Okay, well, welcome to Radio Chaos. How's it going?
Well, thank you so much. I'm doing just great. If we didn't have a war, I'd be in perfect shape.
Well, I was going to ask you, to start the show off, there's sure been a lot in the media about how, the Iraqi people are so grateful that they've been freed and how the Ba'ath Party and the Hussein regime have fallen out of power in Baghdad and how wonderful it all is. And it occurred to me, that whole thing about the ends justify the means, wasn't that Lenin?
I don't know who was the first one that said it. I sort of prefer Aldous Huxley, who said that the means determine the ends. If you use violent, forceful means to get to your end, you can be pretty sure that your end is gonna lead to more violence and more forcefulness. More use of force, because people are going to want to come back at you. And that just seems to be the way people are. And I wish it weren't, but it is.
What about the argument that, as we take over and depose these terrorist states, that keeps us safer from terrorism? That's the Bush administration is telling us that by overthrowing Iraq, they're keeping us safer and making it harder for terrorists to get weapons of mass destruction and things like that.
Well, I wish that were true, and I'm actually a little surprised that we haven't had an overt terrorist act against the United States or against any of our supposed interests overseas during this war. But that's a calculation that you make, and it's pretty easy to calculate that it could lead to a higher risk of terrorism rather than a lower risk of terrorism. I haven't seen a strong argument that Saddam Hussein was directly linked to 9/11. I'm glad his regime fell. He's a rotten guy. But what's going to take its place, and are we sure that in the long run that's going to be better? In view of Iraq's history, we have reason to expect that it's going to be some kind of an autocracy. That they've spent thousands of years without feeling any particular need for democracy, and it's unlikely they're going to make a real success of it. Even with strong guidance from the United States, maybe strong guidance from the United States is the worst thing that could be provided to them.
Sir, you wrote in your I don't know if it's your most recent column, but in the last week or so, a column on antiwar.com entitled Picking Up the Pieces, in reference to this General Jay Garner being appointed to head the new administration in Iraq, you said, quote, "It's the move most calculated to stir up resentment in the Arab world and encourage more acts of terrorism against the United States." Do you mean by that it is the move most calculated? Is that you're saying perhaps it's on purpose that they have picked a guy who will purposely enrage these people?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if they did, and it's probably not personal to Mr. Garner, but the reason I think it's likely to enrage people in the Muslim world is that he's retired military, but just barely retired, and he's going to be taking his orders from Tommy Frank, who's the military commander in the region. And so whatever is there will be seen as a military occupation by the United States of Iraq. So this Carter may be a good guy. He may try to do the most enlightened things possible, but he's going to be seen in that light. And so, you know, I think we're going to have more acts of terrorism.
Well, and I have an article here from April 9th from the Associated Press about Garner and how apparently he had signed on some statement that terribly criticized the Palestinians and praised the Israelis for their restraint. And that was only like a year ago or something. Do you know about that?
I don't know specifically about that, but it wouldn't surprise me. Most American military men are more inclined to be pro-Israel than pro-Palestinian in that particular conflict.
Apparently he's taken quite a stand on that issue, on the side of Israel. It seems like a pretty bad public relations move to put him in charge in Iraq now.
Well, to me, and almost any military man would be a bad choice, but it sounds like this military man is probably going to be worse than most. So it's sad. You know, we think we're going to, you know, get, you know, peace and enlightenment through bombing, and it just doesn't work that way. The world's not like that.
So what is the, well, I don't want to, you know, sum up the whole hour-long interview in a word, but what is the solution to terrorism then? I mean, if we just, if we bring all of our troops home from everywhere on Earth, are we to think that peace is going to break out everywhere?
Well, I doubt if peace is going to break out everywhere anytime soon. And, you know, conflict is maybe endemic to human nature. I hope not. I hope we could have eventually a world in which conflict isn't so central to what we do. But you're certainly going to reduce the points of conflict. You're going to have fewer places in the world where the United States is visibly in the face of people who have reason to be angry. And maybe it's not right for them to be angry at us, but it's natural that they're going to transfer their anger to us if we're in their country trying to run it.
So they kind of might be mad at us anyway, but if our army's in their desert, that tends to really exacerbate it and bring them together, you know, organize them.
Yeah, usually it does. I mean, in the short run, you know, the way that this campaign has prevailed against Saddam Hussein, you know, people may be intimidated, but in the long run, that intimidation factor is going to go away, and we're going to have more conflict. And I think more acts directed against the United States. You know, because, you know, to get to peace and freedom, you act peacefully, it seems to me. It just seems so obvious, and yet, you know, mankind seems eternally able to convince himself that, well, with just this little act of violence here, just this little act of war there, and after that, things will get beautiful and wonderful, and we won't have to do it anymore.
Right? Wasn't World War I the war to end all wars?
Well, that's the way Woodrow Wilson built it, and you'd know, you were his administrator.
So he has read Philip Drew. I see. Yeah, we were debating about you and whether you knew about Philip Drew or not. Is that something you want to talk about at all, or
I don't know.
That one slide.
We'll just let that one fly. It seems to me almost all the, I don't feel a great need to worry about, you know, conspiracies, because it seems like me almost all the conspiracies are perfectly open. The neoconservatives who want to use Iraq as the wedge to get, complete, changeover in the Middle East so that all the regimes there will love Israel have written papers about it. You know, they've been writing papers about it since 1992. They write articles in the Weekly Standard. Bill Kristol co-authored a book. You know, there's no conspiracy there. They want to have regime change in Iraq so as to destabilize the Middle East so that those other regimes fall and become more friendly to the United States. You know, that's the plan they have in mind. I don't think they're going to be able to achieve it, but they've been pretty open about wanting to go in that direction.
I wonder... Let's see, actually, I got a direct quote from you here I think I want to use. This is from April 11, 2001, so this is what you said before September 11th. Quote, a larger, more powerful, more centralized megastate is still close to the reigning paradigm among international relations professionals. So I guess I want to ask you, it's close to the reigning paradigm, and also, if that's true, where's the split between the average, I guess, so-called neoliberal member of the Council on Foreign Relations in their view versus the neoconservatives led by Crystal and Pearl and those guys? Where is that? Where does that split? Because I read Bill Crystal in Foreign Affairs all the time. What's the difference between the neoconservatives and, say, Colin Powell and the rest of the Council on Foreign Relations set?
Well, I mean, to me, the Council on Foreign Relations set, the sort of standard default position there would tend to be, you do whatever you want as long as you get a lot of allies, so you can call it multilateral, you know. And if you can get an international institution like the UN or NATO or some treaty organization or the Kyoto Treaty thing, you know, all these things that these guys in their striped pants go and spend their time having conferences about, if you can get one of those organizations behind you, then you're more legitimate. And the neoconservatives, the Crystals and Paul Wolfowitz's, are more inclined to say, you know, the United States has the right to do things on its own because it is the dominant power, and it's in the United States' interest to continue to be the dominant power and make sure no other dominant power emerges to challenge our power. That's essentially the Wolfowitz doctrine.
But are they both working toward the same ends? I mean, it sounds to me like we're talking about a difference of details, not...
In most ways it really is a difference of details. You know, they want, you know, international megastates to run things, and, can't see another model, can't see a bottom-up model, can't see bottom-up democracy happening, even though that's the only way it's ever occurred in world history, you know, is as... a demand from the people for a different kind of rulership.
So, in terms of the Middle East, then, does that mean that democracy is just not going to work? We can't set up a republic with the different factions in Iraq? You don't think it'll take?
Well, what's happened in Iraq, I would say it's theoretically possible to have a regime in Iraq that was a decentralized regime that essentially, yet the central regime takes care of foreign affairs and you leave all the localities to handle everything else. You know, either you have an extremely decentralized regime with very little power in the central government, or you have a dictatorship. You know, those are the two ways that you can handle, if you think you need a state, that you can handle a multi-ethnic regime, because if you have a central government, the majority wants to have the extra power that the central government has, and they want to use that, and they'll end up, particularly if you're an essentially tribal or clannish culture, as you are in the Middle East and as you are in most of Africa, although there's, you know, different details, but the tribal group that has the numbers in a democracy is going to want to arrogate all that power to itself and will probably use it to oppress the minorities. So if you have a strong central government, you need a real dictator who can, you know, just sort of, you know, kicks butt every other minute or so, or you need a very weak central government so that the power of the central government is not worth seizing, so people mind their own business.
So
those are the two models you want. If you want a stateless model, you look at Somalia.
Yeah, that didn't work out too well, did it?
Actually, it's worked out rather well.
Oh, really?
There's a good piece in the April issue of Liberty magazine by a Dutchman named Van Norden who married into a Somali tribe about 10 years ago and spent the last 10 years living there. And he said essentially what they decided to do there, and they decided in 91 before the UN intervention, was to abolish their central government. They had a tradition of tribal government that took care of most of the tribal affairs and had a system for, you know, punishing people who trespass against the rules, you know, criminals and thugs and stuff. And that was sort of their traditional fallback pattern. when they had the central government, they were always contesting for power. They decided, you know, to stop doing that, and that's part of the reason that the UN intervened in Somalia, because they wanted to have a central government there. You know, that's the way things are done in the modern world. Strong central government equals democracy, stability, all the good things of life. I simply contest that. I think the weaker the central government, weak to the point of disappearing perhaps, is the best way to have stability in a multi-ethnic region.
Well, so does that make you an anarchist or a libertarian or very, very conservative or just Alan or what?
I'd say it makes me very, very libertarian. You know, it depends on my mood that day, whether I go all the way to the anarcho side. It's a theory and practice kind of a thing. The problem with an anarchist society in our present culture is you would immediately have a demand for a central government because people have been conditioned to believe that they need one. And so if there's a demand, then a supply will shortly arise to fill it. That's simple economics. And so you'll have some new thug at the top pretty soon. So I think, you know, our job long run is to reduce the demand for a strong and powerful government by pointing out the fact that most of the time when you have strong and powerful government, you have more chaos and disorder than when you have weak government.
Isn't that always the case, too?
Yes, it is. And yet people equate chaos and disorder with anarchy. When the people use that word, that's usually what they mean. Oh, do you mean chaos and disorder? And if you ask them, they'll say, well, yeah, that is what I mean. You know, when I say that word anarchy, doesn't that automatically mean chaos and disorder? And sometimes I'll just say, who do you think creates most of the chaos? Do you think it's the state or the people?
Well, it's definitely the state from this point of view. I know that.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that.
Yeah, in fact, I was telling my friend in the past week as we've been preparing for this show about your book, Ambush at Ruby Ridge, and how when I read Ambush at Ruby Ridge, I barely got through it. There is an absolute outrage on every single page. And I don't know whether you just wrote it like that on purpose because you didn't want me to be able to catch my breath once or what. But as I turn the pages of this book, there's some sort of fraud or murder or covering up evidence or faking photographs or lying on the stand or on every single page of that book. It's incredible.
Well, I didn't consciously try to keep you from, you know, consciously what I tried to do was tell the story as I understood what happened. And I didn't see it all firsthand, but I did interview most of the people who were direct participants. And, you know, the problem is not the only problem, but once you get an outrage going, and I'm sure those FBI agents up on the hill when they shot the shot that killed Randy Weaver's wife, they may not have been sure they'd killed his wife yet, but they sort of looked at each other and says, oh boy, we've done something really bad here. How the hell are we going to get out of this? And so you start improvising and covering up, and that just sort of leads to more outrages.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem with lying, is you have to keep making up more and more lies in order to make the first one make sense.
Yep. I don't know, the universe has its way with us, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does. We seem to all get ours in the end, except Nelson Rockefeller died having sex with his secretary. And I can't think that, you know, if there's one person who didn't deserve to die in such pleasure, it must have been Nelson Rockefeller. He never did get his comeuppance.
Yeah, maybe he was hating it. I don't know.
I hope so. I don't know. He finally got to be vice president. I don't know. He never did get his dream, which was to rule the whole world. So at least he died before that.
And at least it's, you know, the other nice thing, it really is hard to rule the world. And that's what the United States is going to find out as we get more and more into this imperial phase of the way we run the country. You know, we've been in sort of a unofficial imperial phase for quite some time, but it's more and more, you know, publicly acknowledged. You have your people like Max Boot, who used to be at the Wall Street Journal and now is at the Council on Foreign Relations, writing his little book on little wars and how glorious they were and how they established the mastery of the United States in these military endeavors, and wasn't this glorious? You know, we're going to find out how tough it is, and we're going to find out that, you know, maybe the more you think that you're doing somebody some good, the more they're likely to resent it and come back and hit us with blowback later on.
I got a real problem, though, and that is that when I look at Zbigniew Brzezinski and Richard Haass and Henry Kissinger, for that matter, but particularly Brzezinski, I guess I've seen him on TV a lot lately on the Lehrer NewsHour and so forth, and he doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who is so ignorant that he doesn't see what you and I plainly see and what everybody knows, is that empires fall. That empires are always more harm to the core than good. And I just wonder, how could it be that these people are trying to create this world empire dominated by America? Surely they know that the natural state of things is a terrible backlash against this country.
I don't know how they think they're going to get around it. You know, they look at a few models that seem to have worked. You know, rebuilding Japan after World War II, and say, you know, well, you know, the United States did it right that time, and we can do it right every time. You know, the closest to Iraq, for example, is Afghanistan, which is a smaller country that doesn't have as, you know, that had an even more unpopular government, and actually had people in country who were actively opposing the Taliban government. And what's happened there? You know, everybody was all excited about, you know, we bring in this Hamid Karzai who wears these wonderful capes and looks good to the Western media, and then we sort of ignore it. That's kind of been the American pattern. You know, the United States is kind of an adolescent empire. We have a short attention span. And to really get something decent out of Iraq, we're going to have a very long attention span. And I guess the Brzezinskis figure somehow they're going to lengthen the attention span of the American imperial masters so that we'll do it right this time. I just think the odds are really against it.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe this is the more conspiratorial part of me, but sometimes I wonder whether the plan is that by the time that a single world government is created, that they don't want America to dominate it anymore. They have to have the appearance of a balance of power all over the earth. Right towards the end of Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, I think it was from 1996, he talks mm-hmm. about how America is the only and will be the last superpower. And he precisely names, because we are using our superpower status in order to build this world system that eventually we will only be a part of, not the dominant force of. I mean, it pretty much came right out and admitted it. That they don't plan for there to ever be another superpower again, because the whole world will be a single state by the time we're done.
You know, that's been sort of the vision of the people who see, you know, the bigger and more centralized the government, the better, as the paradigm they like to look at as a model, as an ideal. You know, they've been after that really since, at least World War I. And all the time, and every time it doesn't quite work out exactly right, the reason is always, well, you know, we didn't put enough power into this institution, or we weren't brutal enough in putting down, you know, an insurrection in Somalia or some other place. And so I don't know if they're ever going to be talked out of that model, that what you need to have order is a huge government. Seems just wrong to me.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a way to turn this around. It seems like, let's see. I have here an article that you wrote back in 1999, November 25th, 99, called W's Expansive Vision. This is, a year before the election, and about how George Bush was always an internationalist, and in fact, you quote him talking about these narrow-minded, probably bigoted, overly nationalistic, foreign-hating, short-sighted jingoists who want to create a proud tower of isolationism and turn the country into a hermit republic. that takes no account of and has no commerce with the world beyond its borders. And it seems that that slander of isolationism has been largely successful. People don't even think of independence as the opposite of interdependence. They think of isolationism as the opposite. And I just wonder, is there a way to bring back the idea of independence without isolation?
Well, you'd think there would be, you know, because sort of the essence of what the, you know, what I would call the libertarian vision of international relations is that you have complete and open trade. You know, you would want to have almost no barriers to trade, so that whichever group of people can do desirable things most efficiently and deliver them for the lowest price, they get the benefit. And consumers get the benefit of the lower price and the higher quality wherever it may be in the world. So you have complete and open trade, so that's not isolation at all. That's complete openness, but keep your political relations to a minimum, because political relations are defined as being force. You know, the definition of a state that you'll get in a political theory class is it is the institution that has a monopoly on legitimate use of force. And so that, you know, that's the definition of a state is the use of force. And to me, as the vision I have of a reasonably ideal world is one in which the use of force is minimum, because when you use force, it's almost always a lose-lose situation for human beings.
Well, do we need a World Trade Organization kind of organization in order to have free trade? How do we have free trade without a WTO?
Well,
I mean, there are a million Republicans in talk radio audience land who say, but we got free trade. It's the WTO, dummy. So what's the problem with that?
Well, the problem with that is the WTO is really managed trade. And in some cases, it's managed in the direction of freer trade, as when, you know, some countries go to the WTO and say that, you know, Europe has an undesirable or unjustified tariff against American agricultural products or whatever, and the WTO strikes it down. But to me, you know, the way to do it is to get rid of all your tariffs and invite everyone else to do likewise.
Okay, well,
you don't need a huge central organization to do that.
Okay.
You just do it.
Well, what if I'm Ecuador, and under your libertarian system, there's an American company interested in owning the waterworks, and I say, no way, I'm a socialist, and I run Ecuador, and the waterworks are going to stay owned by the government around here. We don't want to privatize. We don't want to have free market companies running our water. Go to hell. What do we do about that? Nothing? I mean, is that okay for Ecuador to say we don't want free trade with you, and we don't have to?
If you want total justification, then, you know, I doubt if they have justification to, you know, real justification to deprive their consumers of the benefits of freer trade. So they're in essence hurting the people of Ecuador by the stand they take. But I think it ought to be up to the people of Ecuador to recognize that and tell them to stop.
Right. Well, you sound like a libertarian to me, Mr. Fox.
I'd say pretty close.
I'm interviewing the senior columnist from the Orange County Register and a regular contributor to antiwar.com. His name is Alan Bach. And, sir, I noticed that you've written quite a few articles about the politics between China and Taiwan and North Korea and all kinds of things like that. If you want to get into China, perhaps?
Well, I guess the main thing about China is how much do we want to go along with the desire of certain people in the United States to define China as an enemy. I think China is likely to be a power that grows in influence over the next few decades, but does that necessarily make them an adversary or an enemy of the United States? As I define the interest of the United States, which is the freedom and independence of the American people, I don't
think
so.
Well, that's a very interesting definition. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. You said define that again and then tell me how that's different from, for example, the policy of our government right now.
Well, yes, as I said, I would define the core American interest in the world as being the freedom and independence of the American people.
Huh.
In other words, we don't have a bunch of foreigners coming in to tell us what to do or threaten us with rifles, and we don't have and we have personal freedom, so that we don't have people putting a gun to our head and making us do things we don't like.
So liberating the women of Afghanistan from the clutches of the Taliban isn't America's interest, by your definition?
Not America's core interest, no. As an individual person, I'm glad it happened. And I would certainly encourage anyone who's concerned about, you know, the oppression of particular people around the world and, you know, various people for whatever reason, maybe it's ancestry or something they read about or someplace they traveled, is going to be more interested in one country than another. And, you know, if you want to send money to a liberation force there, if you want to go over there like the volunteers in the Spanish Civil War and participate on the side that you think will bring liberation and freedom, God bless you. Just don't bring me into it. and I'll participate in the ones that I think are worthy.
Okay, so in terms of China, they're not a threat to our life and liberty?
It's hard to see the real threat that they are. You know, they obviously are still, you know, in this, what I would call this the grip of the statist delusion, that they think that, you know, a big powerful state is the most important thing to be. So they have this, I think, rather ridiculous fixation with keeping China the same size it is and making sure it never loses territory and all that silly stuff that has not a lot to do with the welfare of the Chinese people. But it's the kind of things that most governments most times and most places do worry about. So you would need to pay attention to the possibility that they might expand and eventually be a real threat, say, to the west coast of the United States. But right now they aren't, so why not trade with them and have diplomatic relations with them, and through the various, you know, subtle lures of tourism and trade, try to bring them around to being a little more sensible. Frédéric Bastiat, the great French economist and legislator, said that, you know, where goods do not cross borders, armies will. So, if we really think that the Chinese are potentially dangerous, we ought to be trying to expand our trade with them. Not because we know for a certainty that it's going to bring about, you know, freedom and goodwill and love and kisses and everybody singing kumbaya together, but because it's less likely to bring threats of war and violence.
Well, I'm reading a CNN article, and unfortunately I just realized it doesn't say a date on here, but I think this is only from the last week or two. China readies for future U.S. fight, and that their whole military is gearing up and doing contingency plans and all kinds of things because they see us as a terrible threat to them. And it says here, hardline elements in the People's Liberation Army had advocated providing weapons to North Korea to help Pyongyang defend itself against possible U.S. missile strikes at its nuclear facilities. It sounds like they consider us an enemy, even if we're trying not to see them as one.
Well, of course they do. You know, the hardline elements in every country need the hardline elements in the other country because it's that perception of a possible threat that gives the hardline elements their capacity to move into positions of power and influence. When Saddam would do, you know, something particularly obnoxious and reprehensible, like, brutalization of the Kurds in the north of Iraq, that gave the hardline elements in the United States who, you know, wanted to be making the case that we ought to think about invading Iraq, another justification. So the hardline elements need each other, and they use each other, and I'm sure they're pretty aware that they're using each other.
It's a pretty dangerous game they're playing. I mean, this isn't a game. This is people's lives we're talking about, right? And the whole Earth and that kind of thing, nuclear weapons. I mean, they seem to be playing pretty fast and loose, like this is the playground at school or something, and not billions of lives hanging in the balance.
In some ways, it's less organized and less cautious than on the playgrounds at school, because on the playgrounds at school, the consequences of making a bad decision you know, are pretty immediate. You know, you get your nose bloodied, or you know, somebody gangs up on you. Whereas the costs of making a mistake in the international arena are usually borne by somebody else besides the person who actually made the decision. And who knows, the person who actually made the decision may end up benefiting, even though a bunch of other people end up losing their lives. So it's really, the more you get away from the face-to-face, interpersonal, the more these things become kind of abstract. You know, we're not really dealing with actual people's lives, but sort of theoretical lives. You know, like it's a board game or a video game or a game of strategy that when I was a kid, people used to play a lot.
Does that explain why they lie so much? That it's, I mean, they really don't care. I mean, I can think just off the top of my head of all the lies that they, or some of the lies that they used to justify this invasion, you know, such as Colin Powell with the Berkeley master's thesis and Bush's forged document saying that Hussein was trying to buy uranium from Africa, and the Al-Qaeda training camp in Iraq that turns out was up in the north in the land that we already controlled. And I just wonder, do you think that's why it's so much easier for them to just make stuff up, is because it's other kids that they're sending to die and they know that they don't really have to worry about it themselves? So they just make up whatever they want to do whatever they want?
That's sure got to, it's got to play into it, it seems to me. I'm a little reluctant to characterize exactly what's going through somebody else's mind when I haven't actually had a conversation with them or read their mind, but it's hard to see how else it could be. You know, you can't make that many mistakes and make those, that many sort of callous decisions that, that somebody else is going to end up paying for unless you're pretty sure that you personally are not going to suffer consequences. I don't know, I read a column the other day, somebody said, as soon as anybody in Congress or the administration, votes for war, you should immediately draft their kids. Or if they don't have a child of that age, their nearest relative who is at the proper age to do military service, so that there would be some direct connection between choices and consequences. So that they would know it was not just, you know, the kids of poor working class people, or the kids of those that didn't have much chance to go to college anyway, who are going to end up suffering the consequences. It's going to be their children. I'm not in favor of a draft under any circumstances. I'd almost be inclined to go for one if it worked that way.
Yeah, in fact, the Democrats that introduced the draft bill last summer did so with supposedly that in mind. They said that they were doing it because it was working-class people and minorities primarily in the military, and they wanted to balance it out. And I just thought, boy, you know, that's a hell of a way to balance it out. There's got to be a better way, you know? Like, maybe we could just shame these people into making their kids join the military instead of having to draft me, too. I'm only 26 here. I'm still on the bad side of the age line for the conscription bill, you know? It freaks me out. I don't want to go die fighting Saudi Arabia. Wait, and speaking of that, I got to ask you this. I'm trying to figure this out. There's this guy, I have it here somewhere, Egypt the Prize. Here we go. This guy gave a speech at the Pentagon. I'm trying to find the guy's name. Lawrence Murrow Week, so this guy from the Pentagon, gave this speech talking about Iraq is the tactical pivot, Saudi Arabia the strategic pivot, Egypt the prize. And I'm just trying to understand, wait a minute, I thought that the House of Saud was our loyal allies for 30 years, and I thought Mubarak has been our loyal right-wing military dictator in Egypt since Sadat got shot when I was a small boy. Why would we want to invade Egypt and Saudi Arabia, the countries we already control?
I guess they figured the control is not as complete as it might be. There's maybe a little too much independence shown from time to time. But again, it's that urge to have international control that to me is It's symptomatic of a really sick approach to humanity and a sick approach to life. if you define what's good as being able to influence or control what somebody else does, I mean, what healthy person really wants to control other people that minutely? It's really sad.
It really is, and it breeds terrible consequences for us. The 19 hijackers were all from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. They weren't from Iraq and Iran, the countries that are still controlled by their own tyrants, or were. They're from the countries that we already control. And they're mad enough to get on an airplane and crash it into us because their government is our puppet. Correct?
Well, that's part of it. And part of it also is that part of the price that the Saud family has paid for relative calm in Saudi Arabia, when, you know, basically one extended family gets all the oil riches, and most of the rest of the country still lives in not misery, but certainly not the lap of luxury. In other words, those riches are not evenly distributed by a long shot. Part of the price is that they have supported these Wahhabi mosques that you know, it's a branch of Islam that's particularly militant, and so to some extent they've been using the oil money to subsidize the creation of Islamic militants around the world, and that's part of the reason that so many of them were from Saudi Arabia. And they, the Saud family, wants all that chaos to be outside their borders. But I think some of it's going to come back and bite them as well.
The whole thing of the Wahhabism sort of brings up to me, I've heard a lot of people saying that they see a lot of religious undertones to this. I remember Bush's original statement about this being a holy crusade against the evil jihad. And then they named the original war against Afghanistan Operation Infinite Justice. And, you know, from my own pretty secular point of view, I don't usually see it this way, but I can see how a religious person might conclude that this is the Jews and the Christians against the Muslims. And I wonder, especially with all the rhetoric indicating that, do you think there's anything to that this has perhaps, like, more religious connotations than just strategic ones than we've been led to believe?
It's certainly possible, and I think it's certainly true in some circles. I can't read George W.'s mind, but there are times when it sounds to me as if he really thinks that you know, waging this war and wiping out the evil ones is doing God's work, and you know, it's dangerous for a person with secular power to believe that it's holy for them to use that power against somebody else, because that, you know, that way sort of breeds a certain fanaticism, a certain, you know, it's been through, you know, we had all those religious wars in Europe in the Middle Ages, and up through the Renaissance. We had, the justification of millions of people being killed in the name of communism, which is essentially a religious belief. That calls itself secular. You know, when you're able to convince yourself that doing right is slaughtering a bunch of other people, you know, then you've got the makings of an ideology that's pretty dangerous for the world at large.
Yeah, I thought that's why we refused to have a theocracy over here in the first place. Maybe that's just my reading of history. I don't know.
Well, that was certainly part of it, you know, and the guys that put this country together most definitely did not want to have a state church, and they didn't want to have religion giving people justification for doing essentially political activities.
Right.
They didn't want to have politicized religion or religionized politics. I don't know. We certainly got a lot of it now, though, don't we?
Yeah, it sure seems we do. And, you know, it occurs to me at the same time how funny it is that here we've been talking about war for almost an hour, and you haven't said the word oil once. And I just thought, wow, well, isn't that funny? Because when I turn on TV, all the anti-war people, I mean, you're the guy from antiwar.com, aren't you going to chant at me that no blood for oil?
I'd rather not have blood for oil, but I think I really think that certainly there's an oil impetus there. You know, Iraq is has these huge proven reserves of oil. It's potentially a tremendously rich resource and should be a tremendously prosperous country if that oil is used properly. And you know, I bet there's a bunch of American companies that think they can use it properly and they'll get rich and they'll pass a little bit along to the Iraqis and make themselves feel good. And control of that resource is going to be more in American hands. I'm sure that's part of the calculation. But I don't think it's the complete calculation. I really think that the desire for power and influence is more at the center of what has been going on at the in the United States government. And I really think that's a more dangerous, motivation. Because, you know, when you're looking for power and influence, then you can justify doing almost anything. Whereas if all you really want to do is make money, then what you want to do is keep your customers happy and antagonize as few people as possible. You know, so...
So the oil men are sort of useful to the neoconservatives who are doing what they want anyway. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's about right. And the fact that this is... That the people who are pushing hardest behind the scenes are those who are more interested in power and in influence than in money. Although they probably won't turn money down, is actually more dangerous to me than if it really were only about oil. If all they wanted was to, you know, to make a few rich Americans richer, you know, that to me is less sinister than the idea that they really do want to control the whole Middle East, and not so they can make money out of it, but so they can make it, you know, righteous and in tune with democratic ideals or whatever the latest blather is. You know, that's... When things are done with those kinds of motivations, that's when a lot of innocent people tend to die. And the people who are responsible for killing them justify it to themselves and say they've done the right thing. And the human being has a remarkable capacity for self-justification that way.
Yeah. You sure sound a lot different than most of the anti-war movement that I've been exposed to. Found this quote from Win Without War. We are patriotic Americans who share the belief that Saddam Hussein cannot be allowed to possess weapons of mass destruction. We support rigorous UN inspections to assure Iraq's effective disarmament. The valid U.S. and UN objective of disarming Saddam Hussein can be achieved through legal diplomatic means. There is no need for war. And I just wonder, like, that doesn't really sound very anti-war to me, because, of course, all world law has to be backed up with force, or it's not world law, is it? I mean, how can that be an anti-war stand?
Well, I don't think it is. I think they would justify it by saying it's a pro-stability stand that will lead to more stability and less chaos. But it certainly isn't anti-war, because, the closest I've heard to an actual justification for this war was from my brother-in-law. I've heard no one else say it. He said, you know, we gave them all this dangerous stuff. Now we got to go get it back, because otherwise it's going to be really dangerous for the world. And to a great extent, that's true. Almost all the chemical weapons and the precursors of chemical weapons is stuff that the United States gave to Saddam Hussein's regime in the 1980s when he was fighting Iran. And then we thought it was in our national interest to make sure that Iran didn't win. I don't think we cared if Iraq won or not, as long as Iran didn't win. And then that war ended in a stalemate. And so here's this regime brutalized by 10 years of war with all these weapons that the United States gave to it, with the experience of having the United States sort of wink and nod when they gassed the Kurds and gassed the Iranians during the war. And so, you know, what would make that regime think that we would object to them, you know, going and taking out Kuwait?
Well, especially when April Glaspie told him that he had the green light and he could go ahead.
At least very, very close to that kind of a wink and nod situation, yeah.
And then, of course, it was our war expelling Iraq from Kuwait and our occupation of Saudi Arabia to do so that animated the Mujahideen and turned them into Al-Qaeda, our terrorist enemies, correct?
Probably not quite as simple as, you know, ABC that way, but it's definitely part of what, you know, made Al-Qaeda a much more militant and more dangerous organization than it had been before. The fact that they were exercised, that these, you know, U.S. infidel troops occupying the sacred places of Islam in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
You know,
hour's almost up here.
Take them out of there.
I was wondering,
you know, why do we have to be in everybody's face?
Right. You know, I don't want to take bin Laden at his word too much, but if he says that, hey, the reason I'm bombing you is because your army's in Saudi Arabia, maybe we ought to take that seriously, you know?
Yeah, at least consider it as an option.
And especially since, while we're at war, especially with a group of terrorists, that our liberty here at home has been in jeopardy too, and I was wondering if we could spend last few minutes on that, if that's okay with you, about our liberty here while we're at war abroad.
Well, I mean, I suppose maybe that's really the bottom line why I'm so concerned about war, because I don't think you can have a war without limiting American liberties at home. And sometimes it's not a direct government law, but there's been plenty of those. You know, we passed this USA Patriot Act, changed the criteria for getting a warrant in the case of where somebody can justify it as being remotely related to terrorism, made it easier for the government to go in and search somebody's house and not notify them. You know, usually in a criminal situation, yeah, if you get a warrant, they can go search your house, but they got to leave a note there saying, you know, the cops have been here, and roving cell taps, all of it to give the surveillance state a little more authority, a little more power, you know, the authority to go in and demand that libraries produce a list of what their customers have been checking out so they can check them to see if there's patterns that show a support for terrorism or... And all this sort of encouragement of suspicion and paranoia among what should be a free people, that, you know, that's the real reason war is so bad for this country. Every time we've had a war, and at least we did in the 20th century, the central government grew a little bit larger, took a little more of the people's freedoms away from them. You know, you had the internment of the Japanese Americans in World War II. You had the McCarthy era during the Cold War, where you know, various political expressions were discouraged almost to the point of being outlawed, and some of them were outlawed. So war is the most persistent threat to American liberties that can be posed. I mean, look, in 1795, James Madison, who basically wrote our Constitution for us, and it's his vision that was the United States of America, he wrote this: of all enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debt and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. You notice how we're worshiping the president these days. Its influence in dealing out officers, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and morals engendered by both. If you're in favor of traditional family values, you don't want war, because war always brings on sexual promiscuity, increased use of prostitutes, increased divorce, increased couples forced to be away from one another and being tempted to stray during that time, increased winking and nodding at that kind of thing. If you want if you want a decent civil society in which people generally respect each other, treat one another with a modicum of courtesy and sort of give one another the benefit of the doubt until it's been proven that they're out to do you wrong, you don't want war. War increases that kind of suspicion. War is as Randolph Byrne said in World War I, war is the health of the state. War is what makes the state grow. Karl von Clausewitz, the 19th century Prussian theorist of war, said that war is simply politics conducted by other means. I would almost say that the converse is true, too. Politics is war conducted by other means, because politics is essentially the effort of one person, group, or interest to impose its will on other people. So, you know, the less of politics, the less of conflict, the less of strife and struggle, the happier I think this world is going to be. But we're a long way from recognizing that yet, it seems to me.
Yeah, I guess that was my final question for you, is do you have any hope that America is on its way to becoming a libertarian society? Is there any reason to believe that people are going to remember the principles of the founders of this nation and save America from the empire and the tyranny to follow?
Well, I guess if I really didn't have hope, I just you know, go rob a bank and find some place really cheap to live, like Guatemala or something, and forget it. The reason I have hope is I think our founders, you know, the people that wrote the Constitution, that negotiated the separation from Great Britain, were pretty shrewd, and they really did love liberty. And so if there's any excuse, by the way, today is Thomas Jefferson's birthday. Now, I would urge anybody to go find anything written by Thomas Jefferson and celebrate his birthday by absorbing his wisdom.
Yeah, start with the Declaration of Independence.
The Declaration of Independence is a darn good place to start, you know. What's the purpose of government and the Declaration of Independence? To preserve the rights of the people, to preserve these rights. They have, you know, they're not there to feed us or clothe us or send us overseas to exciting places where we're ordered to kill people. You know, they're supposed to preserve our rights. That's their job. And when they don't do that job, it's our obligation. Well, I don't know about our obligation. At least we have the right to tell them to stop, and if they don't stop, to overthrow them. You know, Jefferson thought we ought to have a revolution every 20 years. I'm not sure if that's a good idea, but at least whoever is in power is going to tend to abuse that power, and they need to be shaken up, and they need to be shaken up on a regular basis. And fortunately, the guy who wrote our Constitution and Bill of Rights understood that, and if anyone ever goes back and reads those founding documents, they'll be really inspired.
Well, thank you very much, Alan Bock. This has been a great hour. I sure appreciate you joining us.
Well, I hope so, and I appreciate it, and keep the chaos coming, because order comes from chaos rather than the other way around.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Take care.
All right, my friends. That was Alan Bock from the Orange County Register and antiwar.com, where he writes the column, Eye on the Empire. Strongly recommended. I am Philip Drew.